be to the sixth case, Siddiqui versus Achim et al. Mr. Straub.
May it please the court, Eric Straub appears on behalf of Mr. Siddiqui, who is presently detained. Your Honors, the question in this case originally started out with, can the government disregard validly set bond orders if it doesn't agree with those orders outside of the process? We have two orders in this case that were set by Judge Katsavalos, $15,000 and $60,000 bonds respectively, and I'm sure you've read the history of the government's failure to allow those to be posted. My client has now been in custody as a result of that for 14 months. There is a much larger issue, though, that was reached because of the district court's decision. And unfortunately, Judge Randa, number one, decided that he did not have jurisdiction on a writ of habeas corpus to hear this case. He also decided that Mr. Siddiqui had not exhausted his administrative options and that the government ultimately was justified in denying him, or that due process was not an issue because the government was justified under security concerns. So really, because of that court decision, I think we have a much larger question here, which is really the integrity of the bond procedure itself in immigration court. The government has demonstrated repeatedly in this case that it will disregard the law when it doesn't agree with it, or orders when it doesn't agree with it, as well as frustrate Mr. Siddiqui by using a hyper-technical definition of the bond procedure. And I think that it's very clear why they're doing that. Obviously, they want to keep him in custody, and obviously, if you keep someone in custody long enough, especially in immigration court, they tend to give up. They tend to go home on their own and just accept what they view to be the inevitable. The government has repeatedly done that in this case, and I think that they're doing it again with their most recent position on the remand of this case before the immigration judge. On the jurisdiction issue, I think that Judge Randa's decision is clearly contrary to U.S. Supreme Court case law, as well as congressional intent, as those have been expressed primarily through DeMoor versus Kim. There is also a Seventh Circuit case in this jurisdiction, O'Connell, which deals with that question. And if there was any doubt in the wake of those two decisions that a writ of habeas corpus could be used as a method of challenging the unlawful detention of an individual in immigration proceedings, I think that doubt was removed by the Real ID Act of 2005, where the clear congressional intent was that there was going to be a change in the district court hearing habeas corpus petitions, but not as to detention. It was clearly Congress's intent to direct habeas back to this court in all instances except for unlawful detention. So I can certainly answer more questions on that issue, but I really do believe we were very surprised by certainly that aspect of Judge Randa's decision, but I do believe that the case law as well as congressional intent through legislation clearly indicates that habeas is the appropriate remedy here. Perhaps a more significant controversy is the exhaustion question. And first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that exhaustion is not jurisdictional in this case. But more importantly, Mr. Siddiqui has nothing to exhaust. Twice there have been bonds that have been set which he has attempted to post. The government has thwarted his efforts to post those bonds. So it would seem that the government and the district court have argued that Mr. Siddiqui has the availability of going to the Board of Immigration Appeals. Well, in both instances, there was no need for him to do that. He was certainly not going to appeal a bond that he had already posted or that was attempting to post. The most recent incarnation of this argument is that, as you are aware, this case was had a procedural history on the issue of voluntary departure that went through to a briefing stage. Briefing was completed in the Seventh Circuit, and the government, in my opinion, on the eve of a decision on the habeas in front of Judge Randa, decided that they were going to flip their position on voluntary departure and ask for the case to be remanded. When Mr. Siddiqui's case was remanded before the BIA, not a day later, he was pulled from custody up to Chicago, and he was issued a new custody determination form, which I believe is a part of this record. It is our position that the $60,000 bond is still valid in this case. I know it is the government's position, and it was Judge Randa's decision, that somehow this remand started the entire process over and somehow the bond was extinguished. But I think it's very significant to realize that the government, as well as the court in this case, pointed to no authority that would support that position. In fact, I would argue that the contrary is supported by at least the initial ruling of Judge Randa. Judge Randa, on the issue of whether 8 U.S.C. 1226 versus the removal period in 8 U.S.C. 1231 applied, clearly indicated that the government was wrong on the law on that, and that the $60,000 bond did survive, that it did continue because a petition for review had been sought with this court on the voluntary departure issue and a stay had been obtained, as is clearly indicated in the statute. And I would also argue that really, although some cases indicate that there is a difference of opinion on this point of law, that every case that has come down has decided that in favor of 8 U.S.C. 1226 applying in these circumstances. So there is no restart. The petitioner, once they have an initial custody determination, has a right to seek redetermination in front of the court, but that is not something that is given to the government. The government clearly, if they are going to challenge a bond order, has to have changed circumstances under matter of Patel. And that only makes common sense, because if it didn't, then it would render the bond procedure practically meaningless. If IJs, immigration judges, would simply issue bond orders at a hearing and the government was simply free to disregard them, with every procedural change, whatever it may be, claiming that that was a changed circumstance. Well, the government didn't, in my opinion, argue changed circumstances in this case, because really they didn't have changed circumstances. In the second bond hearing, the memo that was in question in this case, the FBI memo, was put before the immigration judge and was rejected as a basis for raising the bond. The judge did find that because Mr. Siddiqui was under a final removal order that he would raise that bond by four times. But I believe his exact words to Mr. Fitter at the time were, you have to come in with more than this. And I think that's really important to consider here, because ultimately what we have is the government deciding to frustrate through a disregard of the law or a series of technical legal maneuvers Mr. Siddiqui's attempt to post this bond. There's a process in place, and the process says that an individual, if they're alleged to be a security threat, has a hearing, and that hearing was had, and unfortunately, the government decided to disregard this. And again, if you've seen the memo, I suppose it's not surprising why Judge Katsavalis came to the decision he did. Essentially, it raises 4 points against my client. One, that he was a bad student. Two, that he says he's from Saudi Arabia instead of Qatar. When I was traveling in Europe, I used to say I was from, with all due respect to you, Judge Evans, I'm a long time Milwaukee resident. I used to say I was from Chicago because nobody knew where Milwaukee was.
Of course. We could take notice of that.
I know how much that pains you. But and then the other grounds were essentially, as far as I can tell, that he was a bad driver and also that he takes trips outside of Milwaukee. Certainly not enough to justify being a security threat. Certainly not enough to invoke the terrorist court provisions if the government chose to go that way. Certainly not enough to invoke mandatory detention if the government chose to go that way. So the government had options in this case. They chose not to take them. And I think it's incumbent upon this court to really reinvigorate the sanctity of the bond procedure in immigration court, because if Judge Randa's decision stands, number one, There's no jurisdiction to bring this on a habeas. Number two, as we've seen in this case, the IJ and the BIA don't have the authority to enforce the bond with any sanction power. And number three, really, if exhaustion is used in this way and we're simply going to allow the government to claim that it's a do-over every time there's some procedural change in the process, then really it allows the government to frustrate the ability to have any bond posted and have any due process. So for those reasons, I would urge this court to enter an order enforcing the $60,000 bond and directing that that be that Mr. Siddiqui be allowed to post that.
Thank you, Mr. Straub. Mr. Duffy?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Edward Duffy, and I represent the Department of Homeland Security in this matter. The facts surrounding Mr. Al-Siddiqui's case have changed as of today, Your Honor. The case that was remanded to immigration court, and I'll be filing a 28-J letter with the opinion of the immigration judge, has granted him voluntary departure and denied an application for asylum, withholding, and removal and protection against the CAT.
I don't understand how the ALJ can issue a bond order and ICE can say, we don't care. We're not going to honor it.
Now, the regulations allow the Department of Homeland Security to revoke a bond after the initial determination that the alien has...
We're not revoking a bond. You're saying we're not accepting... we're not releasing this person on bond. It's a lawful order sent by or signed by an administrative law judge, approved by the BIA. And the government just says, no. How do you justify something like that?
Your Honor, in this case, factually, I think that's incorrect. The initial redetermination was granted by the immigration judge. At the time, and there were some fits and starts as to whether or not the person who appeared with the bond money was eligible to post the bond because he was not a lawful permanent resident of the United States citizen. Then at the second time they went back with the proper bona fides of the individual posting the bond, the guarantor, DHS now had further information and then proceeded
But there's different ways to, if you think this guy is a terrorist, there's a way that you can have him detained because he's a terrorist.
That's correct, Your
we
Honor.
You do it directly, not indirectly.
Your Honor, in this case, I think this was a prudent use of the bond revocation procedure and also the motion for reconsideration to the immigration judge, because the facts, while the DHS had information that Mr. Al-Siddiqui was a person of interest to the FBI, they didn't know the full extent of what the information was at that time. They had a letter from an agent that he was under consideration. Therefore, they revoked the bond under the appropriate regulations, petitioned to the immigration judge to reconsider his setting of the bond, which is perfectly legitimate under the regulations, and then the immigration judge then came back in May and said, I've heard what you said. I find that $60,000 is more appropriate based on these certain changes in circumstances.
He raised it from 15 to 60, but he still said release him on $60,000 bond.
That's correct, Your Honor. But then, the problem in this case is procedurally, he then became subject to a final order of removal. And as the immigration judge, as the district court judge said, he believes that the DHS erred in finding that he was now in post-final order detention under Section 241 of the statute. Now, we disagree. We think that post-final order detention does apply, and the courts have not, and this court in particular has not decided that issue, but the courts that have decided the issue have the Second Circuit case cited in counsel's brief, that was dicta in that case and didn't apply. So the courts have not spoken to whether or not the custody is under 236 or 241 at that point, even though there's a stay issued by the court, because the purpose at that point and the purpose of the statute and the regulation at that point is for the to retain the alien so he can be removed. And this court has stated that in post-final order adjudications, it does have authority to examine whether or not the custody is lawful at that point in time and entertain the habeas corpus proceeding. But this is pre-final order detention. And procedurally, this case has had its twists and turns. But as of October 15th of 2007, there was a new initial custody determination that has not been appealed, he has not sought redetermination, Mr. Al-Siddiqui, of that custody determination. And there is no evidence in the record that DHS, or there's no evidence at all that DHS would refuse to honor a redetermination at this point. In fact, it was DHS that moved to remand the case to give Mr. Al-Siddiqui a chance to apply for voluntary departure after the case was briefed in the petition for review. And he has now received voluntary departure from the immigration judge. At any point during those proceedings before the immigration judge, he could have asked for a bond redetermination from the immigration judge. He had at least three hearings between October 15th, 2007, and today to seek redetermination from the immigration judge of that newly granted detention order as of October 15th upon remand. The problem with him not applying is that we don't know, as the district court judge said, we don't know with the passage of time whether or not the facts have changed in relation to his potential threat to security or other matters as to whether or not the immigration judge would come to the same conclusion in granting or denying a bond in this case. So therefore, as far as the regulations go, DHS was indeed in compliance with the regulations and revoked the bond properly, and then the jurisdiction of the BIA after the final order, the jurisdiction of the BIA went away, and then it became a detention under DHS's interpretation of law under Section 241 of the Act and not Section 236 of the Act. In light of the fact that he now has voluntary departure in this case, he is free to leave at any time. And that is what he sought upon in his petition for review to this court.
How does that happen?
Well, in this case, the immigration judge, and the court doesn't have the order, opposing counsel does indeed have the order.
What jail is he in right now?
I am not sure what jail he's in right now, Your Honor.
How does he leave?
He leaves. What will happen? The procedure at this point is he needs a travel document from Qatar. The travel document would be issued with his cooperation. He provides his passport. He goes to Qatar, proves he's a citizen of Qatar.
How does he go to there?
Well, he does. DHS does the legwork on this. They have a relationship with the embassies. He goes. They will go. They will get the information, provide it to the consulate, generally in about a 21-day period, a travel document will issue. And that varies greatly from country to country. And I confess that I am not conversant in how fast Qatar issues travel documents in their cases. At that point, once he has a travel document, he can leave, and Qatar says you can come to our country, he can leave. In this case, he will leave with an escort because of the concerns, and that is what the immigration judge ordered in his decision today. And then he could depart the United States and return to Qatar. What now complicates this case is that he has pending, and I assume he will appeal, the immigration judge's denial, and that's an assumption on my part, the immigration judge's denial of the asylum claim, which was not an issue raised in his petition for review to this court, but is one that on remand.
His status is different if he's been ordered removed. Wants to contest that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And now he has an appeal to the BIA that he can take as a matter of administrative right. And he still, today, can walk into immigration court to any immigration judge and through his counsel and request the bond redetermination. And he has not availed himself of that remedy at this point. And upon reopening, it's a whole new case. And the evidence of that is, if it weren't a whole new case that reopened on October 15th, 2007, He would not have been able to apply for asylum and withholding removal to the immigration judge because he waived all his rights in his initial immigration proceeding, and the law of the case would apply unless he could show certain exceptions under the statute.
Right. If he's a student at, in this case, UWM, and not in any proceedings at all, and the government thinks he's a terrorist, what is the avenue open to the government to have him detained?
Well, first we would have to, the government would have to issue a notice to appear alleging a removal ground. And then at that point he would be a mandatory detainee under Section 236 if they alleged a terrorist ground in the notice to appear before the immigration judge. Or if the case involved classified evidence, the possibility of bringing a case in a court that's never been used to date is the Alien Terrorist Removal Court, where the use of classified evidence is allowed. So that would be the procedures upon which an immigration case would be started and his detention would be invoked by DHS at that point. He could be taken into custody under those statutes and regulations.
So, Mike, go back to the first question I asked is why, if you have these routes open to the government, think he's a terrorist. He is. You want to take steps that are going to protect the citizens of this country. But you have those options available. Why would you do an indirect thing like this to not honor it's Article 1 court, but it's a court order that he be released on $15,000 and then $60,000 bond, and he comes there with the money or has somebody ready to post it, and you don't. ICE just says we're not going to honor it.
Your Honor, I know the practice
troubling.
It is somewhat troubling, Your Honor. But I know the practice of DHS is to use those charges, the terrorism charges, as the sort of invoking without using the without overreason, it's the nuclear option. I mean, that is a serious charge that requires serious evidence in order to prove the charge. And it's the and at this point, he seemed to be more, based on the evidence, a person of interest to the FBI, and the FBI requested that DHS invoke its powers to examine the case and see whether further detention is available under the regulations. And DHS invoked those regulations and did it properly in this case.
So the bottom line is, Duffy, what so I can understand, what's your position on jurisdiction?
Position on jurisdiction is the court lacks jurisdiction, Your Honor, because the concerns of expressed by the court in DeMoor versus Kim aren't present in pre-final order detention cases. And I think this court's case law in Perryman versus Perry and in the Gonzalez case interpreting that show that if you're going to have a facial challenge to the statute, the court may have jurisdiction to review that. But if you're challenging the discretionary determination of the Attorney General or the Department of Homeland Security to detain someone, then this court has no jurisdiction.
So since, in your view, this is a discretionary decision by DHS.
That's correct.
That's why we're without jurisdiction.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And for foregoing reasons, we believe the court should uphold the decision of the district court judge and deny the appeal.
Mr. Straub, your time has expired, but you may have the 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor's counsel makes some interesting points. He first indicates that there would be really serious evidence that you would have to bring before a terrorist court, and I would agree, and I would agree that we didn't have serious evidence in this case. And I've stated why I believe that. But there is a process in place, and the fact is that the process was not followed repeatedly. And for counsel to say that Mr. Siddiqui has had numerous opportunities when he's been in front of the IJ to again ask for redetermination, well, I mean, I'll let the record speak for itself. The government has repeatedly frustrated his attempts to post this bond, and I have no doubt that if we had asked for another redetermination, which obviously we don't think we have to do, there is a bond in place of $60,000, that if we had asked for another redetermination, there's little doubt that even if Judge Katsavalos would have reinstated his $60,000 bond, that the government would have then put an automatic stay in place and would have requested appeal to the BIA, further frustrating Mr. Siddiqui's attempts to post the bond. They had that opportunity on two occasions when the bond was posted. They did not avail themselves of that. And I think we see a troubling pattern of them attempting to abuse the process by either ignoring the law or trying to really avoid the ultimate issue in the case and throwing technical barriers in front of Mr. Siddiqui in terms of posting this bond. You know, I am not generally a conspiracy theorist, but counsel made reference to the decision that apparently was issued this morning by the immigration judge, which grants voluntary departure under safeguards now, which of course means that if Mr. Siddiqui is going to voluntarily depart, it would be in detention. Ironically, my associate, who is at counsel table, happened to be in the courtroom this morning, I think unexpectedly because we were not on the record, and witnessed the immigration judge handing that decision to Mr. Fitter, and I witnessed Mr. Fitter come in at 10:15 and hand it to me. So you'll have to excuse me if, on behalf of Mr. Al-Siddiqui, that I feel like the fix is in on this, and that I feel like we have gone through every legal recourse that we have can go through to have someone who really, there is no substantial evidence that he is a terrorist. There is a validly posted bond in place. He has a liberty interest, and he has a right under the due process clause. We have gone through every effort that we can to try to secure his release under the law, and it is my opinion that unless this court injects itself into this matter, orders this bond be posted at $60,000, that this will go on forever. Mr. Siddiqui has no recourse.
So that we have it clear, your position on jurisdiction. Exactly why is this not a discretionary action, whatever these actions have been by DHS, so as to preclude us having jurisdiction?
Well, if we were to accept DHS's argument that this is a discretionary decision, then essentially it would allow them to argue in every case where they didn't like a decision by any judge that it's discretionary and they don't have to honor it. It essentially swallows the entire bond procedure up. This was not a discretionary decision. This was a decision to not allow this bond to be posted after a validly ordered bond from an immigration judge.
What do you say to Mr. Duffy's argument that statutorily that is a permissible route for DHS?
I believe that there were permissible routes in this case for DHS to do what it wanted to do. There is a terrorism court. There is a mandatory detention provision that allows them to do what they want to do. I do not believe they did that in this case. They went, they raised their arguments.
You're quite right. They chose not that route. I guess my question, and because obviously it's critical on jurisdiction, always is the route they took, as challenging as it may have presented for Mr. Siddiqui, is it one that is permitted by statute?
Your Honor, I guess I would focus in on the $60,000 bond once that had been posted by the immigration judge in the case. They had the option to continue to proceed with a stay of removal or with an appeal. They chose not to do that. And so I don't believe it's a discretionary decision at that point. They had options at that point to deal with their disagreement over Judge Katsavalos' decision. Instead, they simply decided to not honor the bond. And if we're going to allow the government, number one, not to follow the not just the process of determining whether someone is a terrorist or not that is set up, and the proof requirements that are there, which, by the way, are only probable cause under 8 U.S.C. 1226A, so it's not nearly the serious proof that the government was talking about. But if we're going to allow them to disregard that procedure, then certainly we should require them to follow the appellate procedure that is in place to address their concerns. So I do not believe it was a discretionary call. I don't believe that disregarding the law is a discretionary decision. They had the option to appeal that bond order to the BIA. They also had the option of preventing Mr. Siddiqui's release by an automatic stay. And again, I think that they've chosen not to do that because they really don't have any evidence justifying the reasons they're seeking detention. They're simply putting a discretionary label on something that is, quite frankly, a simple disregard of a lawful court order.
What impact do you see, if any, of today's action by the immigration judge on this appeal?
Well, I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage, seeing as I have not read this 15-page decision.
I
will respond briefly. The fact that Judge Katsavalis has decided to deny asylum, withholding, and CAT, and has decided to issue voluntary departure under safeguards, certainly does not preclude Mr. Siddiqui from appealing the decision, the safeguards decision, or, quite frankly, the larger issue, which is the asylum, withholding, and CAT claim. It would be my position that there is nothing that I have seen in my glancing at the order that indicates that Judge Katsavalis disturbed the bond in any way. So if Mr. Siddiqui chooses to appeal that asylum, withholding, and CAT decision, again, the same $60,000 bond that was posted back in May is still valid. Now, I have no doubt that the government will try to argue, if this court chooses that route to go, that there are now changed circumstances because Judge Katsavalis has decided to deny the asylum, withholding, and CAT claim.
Once there's a final order of removal, which apparently is what you got at 10:15 this morning, then it is discretionary whether a person is held in custody during the removal time after that order is entered. There's a limit to 18 months or something. Somebody can be held a long time, but it is a discretionary call at that time by the Attorney General. Am I right?
I believe that the Attorney General can exercise their discretion and permit release.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. It can go either way.
But
once there is a final order of removal, then things are a little different.
Well, there's not yet a final order of removal, actually. I mean, Mr. Siddiqui is still in the 30-day time period within which to appeal. So the step to the BIA, it's fairly clear that it is not a final order yet. If we choose not to appeal, it will be. If the BIA denies his appeal, it will be a final order, and then we're forced to decide whether to file a petition for review and stay again. But again, I have no belief, and I think the record is completely contrary to the fact that the government would do anything but continue to try to frustrate the process. So I would urge this court that I apologize because before I said matter of Patel and it's actually matter of Sugai, which is the changed circumstances case we've cited it in our brief. But I would urge the court that if you are going to issue an order requiring that the government permit this bond to be posted and Mr. Siddiqui be released, that you also issue an order clarifying what changed circumstances mean. And I don't think changed circumstances can mean any procedural chronology in the case, any change. I think you've got to define changed circumstances in the context of what the bond standards are, which essentially is danger to the community and risk of flight. And I would argue to you that nothing has changed since May, when Judge Katsavalis issued his order, as to those two issues. If we're simply going to allow every procedural issue that comes up to be a quote-unquote changed circumstance, then again, it swallows the entire meaning of the bond procedure whole. And in this case, I would call the government's bluff. They have also had plenty of opportunities, if they had additional evidence or concerns in the last 3 to 4 months that we have been in front of the IJ, to ask for a new bond based on changed circumstances or to avail themselves of the procedures that we talked about that deal with terrorists. They have not done so because they don't have any other evidence other than what you've seen in the FBI report.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Straub. Thank you, Mr. Duffy. The case is taken under advisement.